Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for October 6, 2019. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Join me as always, welcome Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
And filling in for Catherine Smith, who has one more week on her special assignment in Eastern Europe, but I think she is back in the States. But joining us, longtime friend of the show, Rome City Councilwoman, DNC member, Ms. Wendy Davis. Welcome, Wendy.
Thanks for having me, David.
All right. Great to have you. Well, Wendy, this past week, Tim and I, last Sunday, we did a one-topic show. Now, we're not going to do a one-topic show this week, but we're going to start off with that topic and discuss it a little bit. Now, Tim and I will probably we'll try to think of a new thought or two, but we're also going to get your thoughts. And that is what has been going on with the whistleblowers. We know since last week there's now two whistleblowers. There may be even other countries that were asked to provide information, like Australia, like China. Rick Perry may somehow be involved. Republicans like Mitt Romney have even come out and been critical of Donald Trump. What are your thoughts, or what's your take on this whole mess?
Well, mess is the right word for it. It's troubling is the mild reaction to it, right? Sorry. My dog is really bothered by it, too, as you can tell. And frankly, what's more troubling, I wish I could say it was surprising that our current president of the United States feels like our American resources in terms of aid for other countries are his little pawns on some chess game to help his personal political situation or to help his business situation. That's not surprising at all, sad to say. But what is surprising is the number of people who are buying that this is not anything to be troubled about, right? And Mitt Romney being like one of a handful of Republicans who've even made a peep about the problem we have here. I am hopeful that the whistleblower number one and whistleblowers number two will be followed by people standing up in public and saying, this ain't right. And here's chapter and verse on it. But it seems clear that the president withheld funds, aid to Ukraine, hoping to get them to have some investigation of Joe Biden's son. And that's beyond troubling. I think it certainly rises to the level that Nancy Pelosi had to do what she did and move forward with impeachment, that process. And I think that process needs to move forward. And and who knows what else we'll uncover. There's another whistleblower talking about the IRS not treating the president and the vice president's tax records the way that they're supposed to be treated. So there's, scandal after scandal, and we haven't even really started following the money. And I think that's where the real problems this president have in terms of his corruption are.
Yes, Tim, like I said, there's been a lot of new developments, new countries, a second whistleblower. They're trying to pin some of the blame now. It sounded like on Rick Perry. That was kind of and he's going to resign apparently in the coming week, they feel. And John Bolton may even be somehow involved. We've learned a lot of new stuff. Kind of what's some of your thoughts on this week's information?
Well, the thing about the second whistleblower certainly is interesting because apparently the second person has far more, should I say, firsthand knowledge of events surrounding the call and all the other things going on with it than the original whistleblower did. Events are moving swiftly now, as you mentioned. House Democrats, of course, have now issued a subpoena to the White House, and along with the documents request to Vice President Pence, who has, you know, we were talking about it, it looked like Trump was purposely trying to drag him into that last week. Well, it looks like he succeeded, and now the Vice President's in this thing up to his eyeballs. Another thing that we like to watch on this show is polling. And support for the impeachment inquiry is climbing and quickly. A poll of polls now shows that for the first time, a majority, 51%, are in favor of the impeachment inquiry, and 44% are opposed. Historically, that is much higher than it was at this same point in both the Nixon and the Clinton inquiries. I think it's the deal there where Donald Trump, people either like him or they don't from the get-go, and it don't take but 3 or 4 points for the polling to move in one direction or the other to make a significant difference. Get this, guys. 46% now support removal from office, and 45% are opposed. It was never that high with Clinton. It never got out of the low 30s, and it never got that high with Nixon until, about a month before he resigned. So Donald Trump, I guess, is such a polarizing figure, plus the fact that he just very obviously has done something wrong here that everyone can see and that very few except his most ardent supporters can deny. And one final piece of polling. Trump's overall approval rating hasn't really changed through all of this. A lot to chew on.
Yes. Wendy, now let's just look at the Republican Party, not Donald Trump, not Mike Pence, but Republicans that, you know, seemingly are going to try to have a political career after Donald Trump's gone. How much damage do you think they're doing to their legacy and their brand?
Well, I think long term, I can't see how it's anything other than a black mark, a red circle, oh my goodness, what happened to America here in the history books kind of thing. And the Republicans are going to have nowhere to hide because they have been complicit in all of this. And you know, you have, the question now, you already had several Republican parties in states across the country who had started canceling their primary process for the Republican nomination next year. And now you have in South Carolina, you have a congressman, former congressman, who is suing about that. And I wonder if folks will start reversing that. And the three Republican candidates, I think if my number's right, there are three running against Trump. They have something to be shouting about now.
Yeah, well, Wendy, since you kind of got us into that, let's talk about that and we can come back. That was something that came out over the weekend. Tim and I discussed that about, you know, states canceling their primary and how that seemed to be anti-democratic process. And we don't mean the party, mean the, you know, having a democracy. And there is a threshold to where, yes, there's really no candidate, so you cancel the primary and have an incumbent president. But in this case, they had three other candidates, and Donald Trump is quite polarizing. Even within the party, there's a lot of never-Trumpers that may be still kind of laying low and swallowing their pride, not talking. Being somebody that's in the National Committee for the Democratic Party, what's your thoughts on where's that threshold for when you cancel a primary or when you have a primary, and then I guess in this case, Republicans 2020, is that, should that be the case?
Well, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head. It's not Democratic with a little d, right? Again, if you have incumbent, I mean, I know there's a history of having an incumbent president who is up for re-election and there are no serious challengers and folks have canceled their primaries. In my mind, if there's anybody there, you need to have the election. You know, it's not going to be a very heavily contested thing, but you still have it. It's part of our democracy. I don't think, you know, a handful of folks should be able to make that determination in these states. I find that actually pretty troubling. But I also know that the way the primaries or caucuses are done in each state are, you know, varies widely.
Wendy, let me jump in with a question about this. Could you imagine the firestorm that would have happened in previous election cycles if the Democratic National Committee had basically moved into states as the Republican National Committee pretty much has, and just said, you know what, we're supporting the incumbent president, we're not even looking at any other candidates, no one else need apply, and to make sure we're canceling elections. Could you have imagined what would have been said if y'all had done something like that?
Well, I mean, to be fair, some states did that for Obama's second term, right? But I can tell you from my short time that I've been on the DNC, we're not go along to get along kind of folks, right? We got a lot of people out there who speak their mind and have their mind, and a good many of us tend to be Democratic with a little D first before Democrats
but Wendy. But, Wendy, what if President Obama had three announced opponents for the nomination, you know, former governors and congressmen and stuff like that, like this president does? Could you have imagined what would have happened then?
if anyone had been bold enough to try to make that happen, I think there would have been a lot of pushback on our side. I really do think there would have been a lot of pushback. But again, you're dealing with, you know, the current occupant of the White House, you know, exhibits all the predominant characteristics of a bully. And the folks in the national Republican leadership, such as it is, I mean, they're just toeing the line. And maybe they were expecting that turmoil would arise, and so they were trying to get ahead of it and sort of stack the deck, but I think it'll be interesting to see if the deck starts getting a little unstacked or reshuffled.
Well, Tim, let me ask you a question about this. Bob Inglis, he sued on behalf of apparently many South Carolina Republicans. Will this make a difference, or will they just ignore him, or do they think that he's, you know, maybe friends with Mark Sanford in this case?
No, I think they're going to try to just ignore it. Not only has Trump made moves as president to basically just take over the whole national apparatus of the Republican Party, including the Republican National Committee, but they have gone into these individual states and gotten his people into all the leadership positions. And they pretty much can do anything they want to do. And, you know, they take a cue from their boss up there in Washington. He's made it very fashionable to basically say, you know, I'm going to do this. Now, what are you going to do about it? And basically, that's where we're at in South Carolina. If they decide to stick, what do they do about it? Now, I know we're talking about the court system, too, here, but, you know, they've stuffed the courts with their own people, too. So So I'm of the opinion it's not going to go anywhere. It's not going to make any difference.
Well, I think it'll be interesting to see because I'm sorry to interrupt, but I think because the courts are involved, that raises the stakes of it, and I don't know how they have. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what arguments they use to justify their decision, right? Because I imagine that those three other candidates in that race have probably gotten a little bit of a fundraising bump or help or whatever the right word is for it in this past week. So, and particularly in South Carolina, I don't know how you can say the former governor is not a credible candidate in that primary.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wouldn't say that, but apparently there are many in the Republican Party that are saying that because basically the president wants them to say that. And, David, what do you think? You think it'll go anywhere?
I think you're unfortunately right that nothing will happen this time because Donald Trump seems to have a stranglehold on, making all these folks in the Republican Party, or too many of them, fear him. I think little d democracy, the way we need to, or democratic, the way we need to approach these things is if there was some way we could partner the presidential primary with municipal elections, maybe, you know, splossed or bond elections, some kind of apparatus where you could say, hey, we're not spending any extra money. We were going to go to the polls anyway, and then we're going to vote for presidential nominees, both sides, be it if there's a very popular incumbent president that's running for re-election, or if it's a wide open 30-person affair, like we had a few weeks ago on the Democratic side. Either way, we're going to have that primary along with this other thing. Therefore, you wouldn't be in these situations of what is a credible candidate, how strong is a strong candidate, because that gets sometimes, I guess, into opinions instead of facts. Well, let's keep moving on, and I actually kind of want to move back, so I want to ask Wendy your opinion on the Democratic side of impeachment. And I guess there's been two schools of thought. Donald Trump's done wrong. He needs to be paid for it because it was illegal. Let's impeach him. Others are saying, well, this might hurt us politically. We need to get him at the ballot box because we're never going to get him in the U.S. Senate. So therefore, we have to, kind of let his term play out and then win in 2020. I understand both sides, and this is really before this latest, I think, has become where it's just the preponderance. It's just too much to let it go. But you being on the DNC, what are your thoughts of how the Democrats will or should approach this?
Well, I mean, I think you laid it out really nicely, sort of what the two sides from the Democratic perspective were, right? You saw a lot of people thought that, the Republicans got a lot of backlash from the Clinton impeachment, but I see that as being a very different animal, so to speak, right? Because the matters were just politics, just politics. But particularly given what's come out about Ukraine and, what other additional shoes are going to drop. And I mean, you have to look at it, just like we were saying, how is history going to look back on this? There, at some point you have to say, this is not just ineffective leadership, or it's not just an uncouth way of speaking, or an incompetent way of preparing for your foreign relations conversation. This is just wrong and crooked, and you just have to stand up and say enough. And we've gotten to that point. And I don't want any of this to happen. I wish he weren't participating in these activities that are so troubling. But unfortunately, I think there's a lot more out there, and I think more of it is going to come to light. I think the people who've already left his administration may feel like now is the time that they have to sort of come clean about everything they know, and it might get deeper before we, you know, get it resolved or get into actual impeachment hearings.
Yes, and I've got one more question in the same vein, and then Tim may have some other things. And that would be that this Ukraine situation involves one Democratic candidate, the person that when he started this whole process was seen as the front runner, Joe Biden. Do you think all of this is a net positive or a net negative for Joe Biden, the way he's been attacked?
I'm not in any way seeing how it's positive for Biden himself. I think Biden's in a no-win situation in a lot of ways, because if you don't respond to the attacks, and Trump is just going to continue to attack, he's just going to continue to tell lie after lie after lie about what he is, you know, proposing that the Biden son might have done, or how the vice president might be involved in it. And so there's that dilemma, right? Do you respond? And the vice president, former vice president, has responded, right, and responded very clearly and very succinctly that there's nothing there to be talking about. But Trump's going to keep hammering at it. And so the question is, when does Mr. Biden stop talking about it? And just
I guess this is my line of thinking with it seeming like it could help him. One, when he gets attacked, he is seen as more sympathetic by the party, in particular the more left side of the party. Also, it raises his profile, and that it then underpins that electability argument, the reason that Donald Trump went to these, you know, drastic illegal measures is because he saw the need to weaken Joe Biden because he couldn't defeat him, you know, fair and square. But I'll pass it to Tim for anything else he might have to wrap this up. Tim?
Yeah, staying with that for just a minute, Wendy. It's been talked about by a lot of the pundits on the talk shows and stuff that the voters are simply getting fed up to the point of exhaustion. The voters are just exhausted with all of this, and that may be why anyone whose name is even connected with this particular issue, this Ukraine thing, the voters may decide, you know what, let's sweep this clean and start over, in which case it would hurt Biden. Is that a fair assessment?
Oh, I certainly think it's a fair assessment, and unfortunately, it just adds another layer of question. Although David's right, Trump's not going out and attacking people who he doesn't see are at the top of the heap, right? And Biden's mm-hmm. clearly a front runner, if not the front runner, by everybody's estimation. But I just think it adds to that feeling of, Lord, we've been here before, right? Of the Republicans telling lies and, you know, acting like there's some scandal on the Democratic side that isn't there, and it just gets all muddied, and it hurts you, right? The mud
mm-hmm.
hurts you.
Mm-hmm.
Even if there's no there, they're not going to stop talking about it, and everybody's going to be sick of hearing it. And the people who watch Fox News have already decided that, you know, Biden did the same thing when he withheld aid previously because they weren't going against the corruption that was in the country, right? So, I mean, it's
mm-hmm.
just, it's a mess, and I don't think it helps anybody.
Mm-hmm. Now, I mentioned that the polling is showing, and Nate Silver, among others, have mentioned this, that Trump's overall approval rating has not really changed that much on account of all this. Are people's positions on Donald Trump just pretty well set and not to change?
They seemed to be, right? But I really feel like there something. This past week or 10 days or however long it's been, it feels like it's been forever, but it's just been a you know, a blink of the eye in a lot of ways, so many different things that have come out, right? So you have all this Ukraine scandal. You have the stuff about the snakes and the alligators on the in a moat on the border, right? You have shoot people. Just go ahead and just shoot them, right? And there are some people who are finally fed up with that sort of, you know, that cavalier, I don't care what the law is. This is what I'm telling you to do, and I'm president, do it. And there are people who are finally, I think, getting a little sick of that, and they don't feel like that's how America is supposed to work.
So you think there's still a persuadable middle in the country, a measurable, persuadable middle that could move in a significant way one way or the other, depending on how this turns out?
I do. I 2 weeks ago, I wouldn't have felt that way.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, things are happening in a hurry, that's for certain. That's all I got on this subject. Thank you, Wendy.
All right, well, let's kind of move on to something else, and that would be the fact that we all live in the state of Georgia, and Georgia quickly, a few weeks ago, became really maybe the most interesting state in 2020 politics, because yes, it's supposed to be, looks like it's going to be a swing state for the presidential election, but it has not one but two Senate seats. One's an incumbent that'll be running for his first reelection, David Perdue, and the other is just flat out open seat. And the thought is that those seats will both be in play. Maybe not the number one targeter by any means, but one of the, say, two of the top five or six targets. Wendy, kind of give us your thoughts on, first, I guess, how Georgia lines up, and particularly, I guess, David Perdue running for re-election.
Well, I think David Perdue might need to be worried about what's turning for President Trump, because David Perdue has been one of his strongest supporters, apologists, you know, go-to guys for the president, and he's not going to be able to hide from that in a minute, right? And, you know, his plan all along has been, you know, I'm with Trump, I'm with Trump, I'm with Trump, and I think that's going to carry him. You have all these farmers who are angry because the aid was held up for so long from, you know, the hurricane last year, right? It's there's a lot of bad things, and although a lot of people will say and a lot of the pundits say, well, Georgia just thinks they're purple, they're really still, you know, kind of leaning red, I would say that, you know, they're not completely off base with that, but I don't think David Perdue on his own has connections to any part of the electorate other than the Republican elite. And I don't mean by voters, I mean like just party insiders, right? Like dozens of people, not hundreds or thousands of people. You know, his strength is just that he's going to have an R after his name. And the question is, will that still be a strength by the time we get to next November?
Yes, and I guess you forget, though, that he was in charge of Dollar General, so those could be his people, too, his shoppers. Well,
the shoppers don't know who owns the company, David.
I know they don't. I say that in jest. Since Dollar General's become so controversial where they're opening so many stores and closing out everything else. Well, before we get into the other side of this with you, Wendy, I do want to ask Tim, because we have yet to talk about this. Other things have been on the plate. For this open Senate seat, we knew that, you know, we've talked about names that may get appointed. But then Brian Kemp went and did something very unorthodox, let's say. He opened it up for anybody in Georgia to fill out an online form, submit their resume or their curriculum vitae, and they can apply for this U.S. Senate seat. Tim, what do you think the angle is here? I mean, is this truly he may find the diamond in the rough that wouldn't have known about otherwise?
No, you know what? I think he's got a small list of names that he and his people are looking at now. But it is good politics to do this. There can't be no downside to doing this, especially if some name Republicans have put their names into the hat, as apparently has happened, you know, with some Congress critters expressing interest in, like, power people in the legislature expressing interest, and both male and female expressing interest. So I think it's probably, politically speaking, a good move on his part. Now, will he pay attention to any names on that list? Does he already have his person picked? I think he's got a pretty good idea of who he wants to put there, but obviously he's going to play it close to the vest. He's going to keep that name quiet as long as he can, because it keeps interest in the thing, and it doesn't help the Democrats to know who they'll be running against anytime soon. So I think it was a smart move.
And the one follow-up question, Tim, is do you think that it will take somebody out of the running? You know, we talked about our big names. We mentioned, like, if it got to the situation where it was going to be incredibly difficult to hold and Nathan Deal was going to be the only person to hold it, would it be where if he wanted to pick Nathan Deal and Nathan Deal said, I'm not filling that form out, I'm the former governor, would that just automatically take him out of the running? Is the person he's going to pick have to fill out this form?
No, I don't think so at all. I really don't think so at all. I still think fill out the form, don't fill out the form. I believe that he already has a little handful of names, a quote short list, and I got a feeling our DNC members going to agree with me on this. He already has a short list of people that he's looking at right now and has from day one. Would you agree with that, Wendy?
I absolutely agree that he's already got a short list. Now, I would disagree. I think that would be a quite the tactical error to make for him to have not made sure that whoever he's going to appoint filled the form out, even if they filled it out the day before he appointed them, right? Like, I think then he looks like a bad guy, right? You can't say, I'm going to do some big open process and then not have it be an open process. I think the reason that he may be doing this open process is to give himself cover, you know, for the dozens and dozens and dozens of people who think they're important to him, who he doesn't appoint. You know what I'm saying? And at least some of them he can, well, but you didn't apply, right? I couldn't pick you if you didn't apply. So I really think that's more what it's about. It's also a delaying tactic. As you say, it hurts us more than it hurts any of them. But I think he's I don't know how much longer he can delay and expect his appointee to be able to get up to speed and be ready to roll January 1.
Yeah, but it's one of the reasons that a lot of our heavyweight Democratic candidates are over in the other race and not necessarily in this race because of the fact they simply don't even know who they'd be running against, right?
Right. Well, and the reality is that qualifying isn't until next year, right? So people can move around and switch around. Just because you have a committee that says you're running for U.S. Senate doesn't mean you have to run for one seat versus the other seat, right? So I think it'll be tricky for somebody to switch, but again, his delay is hurting us more than it hurts whoever he's going to appoint.
Makes sense. Yes. And I'd like to say one more thing, David. Go Braves. Okay.
Okay. Yes,
go
I'm so
Braves.
Excited that they won. So it's now 2-1.
Two to one, Bravos.
All right. Well, I guess y'all need to timestamp this so people know when we're recording. Well, another aspect of this, just in the past week, I think Jan Jones, who's in the state's legislature, she's expressed her interest, and Newt Gingrich's daughter expressed her interest. And I know with the case of Jan Jones that she, you know, made a point of, you know, it's probably about time that that a woman wins Senate, given that the first U.S. senator was Rebecca Felton, and they hadn't had one since. Do you think Brian Kemp will look at Georgia diversifying, and that could not only be by gender, that could be by race, but do you think that he will pick a non-white male, Wendy?
No.
So that was short and simple.
I mean, I could expound on it if you want me to, but I just don't think they get it yet. You know, I think a few pundits get it, but they do the party from the national level through the state level through, you know, even the folks I see working at the more local levels, they do not look at the women who are Republicans as people they need to worry about bringing into leadership. If they do, it feels just very token and not like they mean it, right?
Wendy, why is their hierarchy that way? I mean, why did they disregard totally the 55% of citizens who are women, and secondly, the 53% of white females voters who voted for Donald Trump? Why do they disregard them, do you think?
They're happy for them to get the work done. It's a patriarchal system. Our whole country is still a very patriarchal system, but their party is, you know, hanging on to it, clinging tightly to traditional roles and responsibilities.
But it looks like even they could count, right? I mean, count heads.
If they could really count, they would have been doing something to reach out to voters of color, and they have just doubled down, tripled down, quadrupled down on racism and stoking racial tensions and divides and fears. And I mean, that's certainly the president's modus operandi.
Mm-hmm. But why don't they look at a county like Gwinnett County and say, you know what, that isn't working. Again, we're counting heads here. They've got to be able to look at these election results in our very state since 2006 and just see them getting closer and closer and closer, and they're starting to get just wiped out in the donut counties, and they're losing, especially highly educated female voters in droves. I mean, I don't know. I'm an old political hack, Wendy. I'm used to counting heads, and the best way to do it and the best way to get that majority of heads, and I'm scratching my head about this. It's a losing proposition, as you say, and they still are pursuing it.
Right. Well, I think that it's, old habits are hard to die, and you might be no spring chicken, but you're a forward thinking person. One of my favorite old jokes is if you get in a car, you know, if you want to go forward, you put it in D. If you want to go backwards, you put it in R. Right.
Uh-huh.
And that's just where they are. They're not forward thinking. They're not comfortable with progress. They're scared of this future that they see the power being ripped away from, you know, the people who've had all the power, and that is, you know, a majority of, you know, Caucasian men, right?
Okay.
Well, Wendy, it's kind of a setup to my next question. I'll go ahead and tell you, about 3 weeks ago, we all came up with names we thought would be interesting, and I came up with the one that I thought would be very interesting for the Republicans, and that would be Ashley Bell, someone who's probably in the early 40s, African-American male, who actually supported Donald Trump in some fashion on some committee. And that would be a way to diversify their party, and then knowing that that person would run for re-election in 2022 with Kemp on the ballot would be a way for Brian to look out for Brian, you know, because I do think he has to look at that somewhat. But I'm not going to ask you what your thoughts is on that name. Do you have any names that if you – I mean, like for some reason, Brian Kemp asked your opinion, but you had to do it from a Republican perspective, who are some of the names you think that would either bode well for him, or who do you think he will pick?
Well, I'm going to resist talking about my friend Ashley Bell because he and I got to know each other when he was really active with the Young Democrats, right? And
yeah.
He worked for John Edwards, if I'm remembering right, or was a surrogate for him, one or the other. I think that sort of knocks him out there in a lot of ways. Although, you know, we've had, you know, governors who are Republicans who used to be Democrats, so maybe my theory is out there. But I kind of thought they might be on to something with there's some couple well-to-do and successful business women that had been mentioned. And I apologize, their names aren't coming to me right now, but those are the ones I thought that if he was going to surprise people, that he might go in that direction. It would definitely have to – I don't see him picking any of the women who have been – legislators, because again, even if they have titles, they haven't been given power, it doesn't seem, within the Republican leadership. So I don't see him necessarily doing that. The most surprising thing he would do is if he picked somebody younger than himself, right? Because he's sort of the next generation, the governor is. Now, a lot of people were talking about BJ Pack, but I understand that BJ Pack took his name out of consideration and certainly hasn't applied. So, it might be smart of him to do it for a long-term plan, but the reality is that whoever they pick has got to be prepared, you know, to run, to stand up a statewide, 20, $30 million race in less than a year, right? And then turn around and do it again for 2 years later, right?
Well, Wendy, there's three ways he could go. He could choose a placeholder. He could choose a power name, someone like Sonny Perdue, Nathan Deal, somebody like that. Or he could go completely out of the box and surprise everybody with this bold, aggressive pick. Of the three choices, what do you think the governor would be most likely to do, or do we have any way of even having a clue?
I mean, again, I think the easy money, as the bettors say, right, is for him to get a same old, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or find the next David Perdue, right, rich person. Everybody's in love these days with self-funders because money is such a huge part of the
mm-hmm.
statewide campaign. So,
power name then is the most likely scenario?
I think whoever it is has to have a lot of money or a lot of resources, right? I mean, he might do something crazy and, you know, act like Newt Gingrich still lives in Georgia or something. You know, who knows?
Okay. I like that.
Well, Wendy, let's get over to the other side of this thing. There's the occupied seat by David Perdue, and we have Columbus Mayor Teresa Tomlinson, Clarkston Mayor Ted Terry, Sarah Riggs Amico, and John Ossoff all announced for that seat. And then in the open seat, we've only had Matt Lieberman, son of Joe Lieberman, announce on that seat. So I guess he's the only announced candidate that entire Senate seat since the Republican nominee hadn't been picked. Give us kind of your thoughts on what the two primary races are shaping up like thus far, and if there's going to be any other people to possibly look for.
Well, I mean, I certainly think that there, you know, maybe more people who get in on the Purdue seat, if you will, right, the full-term seat. I think our the Democratic side may be about set. You know, there are a lot of people still talking that, you know, we're missing a significant candidate who's a person of color in that race. Again, the clock is ticking in terms of someone having to be able to stand up a campaign and raise the millions of dollars to be competitive in the primary. And then, of course, the thing that makes that second race, the open seat, so tricky is there isn't a traditional primary and then general, right? So the November election next year will be an everybody run. So they won't go through the primary process next late spring, early summer, right? It'll just be everybody running in November. So, you know, the question is, does the governor pick somebody who is strong enough that no up-and-comer says, I could take them on, I could beat them next year? I don't think anybody should count on that. I think so much is going to happen at the presidential level, and with this impeachment stuff, it's all going to be mixed up, put in a blender and spun around. And so I think anything we guess today, we'll look back and probably chuckle at ourselves if we thought there was going to be anything simple about next November.
Yes. Well, let me ask you one more question, and Tim may have some more. If someone came to you and asked your advice, if they wanted to run, would they be better in just getting everything put in place and then waiting to see what happens in that open seat, or should they just go ahead and jump into either the occupied seat with four candidates or the David Perdue, or the open seat that Matt Lieberman's jumped into?
Well, I mean, I think we've got to have a longer conversation, right? It depends on who it is, right? If it's John Lewis, right? I tell John Lewis, get in that open seat, win it, have 2 years as our senator, and then retire with that as your last big piece of of your story of your heroic life, right? if it's somebody who has not ever run for office before, I'm going to ask them all, why don't they run for something close to home, right? I'm not a big fan of people who've never run for dog catcher running for U.S. Senate, personally. I think it's there's a lot of learning you have to do about campaigning, and that's the U.S. Senate campaign is right there. There's only really one other office that is more complicated in terms of how campaigns go, and that's running for president.
Yes. Tim, anything else on this Georgia Senate race?
One more question, Wendy. If such a personage as John Lewis jumped into that open seat, wouldn't it then force the governor's hand to perhaps do something different with that seat than what he had planned to do to start with? Wouldn't it be smart for someone of John Lewis's stature, if they were going to run, to go ahead and get in there right now?
No, actually, I still think because we know the governor has to make the appointment before the end of the year.
Uh-huh.
I think it's okay to wait right now and see who he appoints,
mm-hmm.
right? Because I think it makes all the difference in the world. So right now, all this Mr. Lieberman has, right, is I want to be a senator,
mm-hmm.
right, and I want to fix the mess in Washington. But you know, we will have the more of the contrast of, you know, I wasn't going to run for Senate, and then I saw this, and I see all the mess in Washington, and you know, this person is not who should be representative. You've got to have the contrast. Like right
mm-hmm.
now in Georgia, it can't be all nicey-nicey, you know, I'm just running because I want to represent Georgia in the Senate. You know, I want to take Georgia to Washington. I mean, that's not going to be enough to cut it. We've got to have our people have to be outwork and outshine the Republicans, right? You've got to beat them. You can't just be yay and positive.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
Wendy, for a second, I thought you were going to say outwit, outlast, outplay, and I was like, that's Survivor. well, let's move on to our last topic.
Let me add one more thing. You know, I don't expect that Congressman Lewis is going to do it, but the person who I thought might be an interesting person to take that on, you know, because I was thinking, you know, who is somebody who could keep other people out of the race? And it, you know, maybe it's just because I've known him for so long and it's the first campaign I really worked for. But, you know, Minority Leader Steve Henson has said he's not going to run for the state Senate again, but I don't know. Maybe that U.S. Senate seat might call his name.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely would have experience to run for it, unlike a few of the candidates that have jumped in so far in the two seats. Well, let's move on to the presidential race. We've had a lot of debates, you know, lots of candidates on the stage, and this was kind of a DNC process, and you're a DNC member. Tell us your thoughts on both A, the debates, and B, the primary process so far.
Well, I mean, I think the debates have been interesting. You know, the additional forums that have been out there that have been televised have been in a lot of ways more interesting, right? Because you get a little bit deeper conversation than the, you know, than the 2-minute sound bites or a little bit of back and forth jabbing at each other. I keep trying to tell people we're a long way from having this nomination settled, a long way. And I don't quite understand why people feel the need to have this wrapped up right quick. that's just not the way things work or go, or the way things have been historically. And so I think getting it down, I think, what are we, down to 12 or 11 for this next debate? You know, a lot of people who think that's way too many. Obviously, the people who are supporting people who didn't get on that stage think it's not quite enough. But I think we're going to probably have a field of probably 8 going all the way into the new year if folks' money holds up. And we'll know more about their money when these next disclosures come out, although a lot of people have already offered up the millions of dollars they raised this quarter. So, and it's funny because, you know, people think the DNC had a lot to do with this process, and the DNC, as in the chairman and his staff, had a lot to do with the process. As DNC members, the only real input we've had, you know, people, we've made it clear that we wanted the process delineated early, so people weren't saying that the DNC had put their finger on their scale to help or hurt anybody. And I feel like, you know, the interesting twist at the last DNC meeting, we had a big debate and battle and a big contentious vote about whether we were going to have a single issue debate as one of the official DNC debate about climate change. And I was on the side that says, you know, how do we pick one issue over the dozens of issues that are of critical importance to the nation right now? And I think we have had forums that have dug into the climate change issues. And folks are addressing that. The campaigns are addressing that.
Yes. Tim, questions for Wendy about the debate process and then the race itself.
Wendy, I'm looking at the latest polling data, and I see 11 candidates who have 1% or more, and the rest do not. Do you think when we're looking at these debate lineups that the voters are looking at it pretty much seeing the same people on the stage debate to debate, and it's getting baked in the primary voters' heads already that they're actually just a little limited number, maybe three or four of the candidates who could realistically win the nomination.
I mean, that's what a lot of people are saying, but I'm telling you, where we're, I mean, I haven't looked at the polling, and maybe y'all have, but where were we in October, you know, the year before? Nobody ever heard of Jimmy Carter, and he ended up president.
Yes.
All of us thought Donald Trump was a joke because he was, and he's our stinking president, right? Like, time and time again, Obama, nobody knew his name in October of the year before. Well, a handful of people did, but you know what I'm saying? He was not. And so what happens in the primaries matters, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not just about who raises money and has a not you know a successful debate a year before the election, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's the primary process. It goes to the voters, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so people would have told you, people on a show like this would have said, oh, America's not ready for a black president. Not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Not going to happen. They said America's not ready for a woman to be president. And she wasn't president, but by golly, she won the popular vote by 3 million votes, right? So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I think we need to have time for at least a few voters to weigh in. The primary right now is about who's going to have the money to keep a team together to compete in those early contests and maybe be the surprise.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But this is an over by a long shot, and people are not remembering, right? The Republican Party, the reason that Trump was able to secure the nomination is because so many of their states are winner-take-all. The Democrats, I don't think we have any state that's winner-take-all. It's all based on how candidates do in the congressional district as well as statewide, the way those delegates are divided up. And I see us having a hard time. Unless a whole bunch of people run out of money, I see us having a hard time seeing someone with a direct path to the number to clinch the nomination as early as we've sometimes seen that.
Mm-hmm. Now, when they're on the stage, we know from polling that we've seen that by far, even though these other issues are very noteworthy, and I'm glad our candidates are talking about them, but by far, the number one issue, and it's going to remain that, is Donald Trump and who is the person who can defeat him. But based on that, do you believe that the candidates should turn their attention to, shall we say, more aggressively going after Donald Trump in these debates than they have so far?
To be honest with you, I am delighted when we don't talk about Donald Trump in these debates because we all know that to be a given, right? We all know we've got to beat him. We all know, I hope we all know, all of our candidates down to number 25 or 26 would make a sight better president than this man has made. But what we need to do is we need these debates to be having our candidates being able to share their clear vision for A, their leadership qualities, and B, the particular policies that set them apart from each other, right? And their capacity to put those plans and policies and ideas into action.
That makes sense.
So it's like
to
I'm
me.
Really, I'm really intrigued by Andrew Yang, right?
Uh-huh.
And this what does he call it? Dividend. Freedom dividend, right? Like, I'm intrigued by that. I don't think for a minute he'd necessarily be able to deliver that, but it's an interesting thing for us to talk about, right? And I particularly think his conversation about how jobs and our economy are changing is a conversation we need to be having, right? So I'm glad he's there for that. Do I think he's going to be the nominee? No. But I think we've got to have some candid conversations about the future and the kind of leadership it's going to take to help us with these transitions that are really just beginning in terms of how the realities of our day-to-day lives are going to continue to be impacted by technology.
And the other side, of course, when we are talking about some of these new issues are using the S word, socialism, socialism, socialism. But I don't believe that old dog's going to hunt next year, do you?
Gosh, I would love for you to be right, Tim, but I'm scared to death that, you know, they'd call you and me a socialist.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because the Republicans are not anchored by worrying about the truth.
Uh-huh.
Yes. Well, guys, it looks like we've kind of wrapped up an hour. Wendy, thanks for joining us tonight.
Sure. Thanks a lot. Y'all have a good evening.
Yeah.
Good night,
and
until
next week, it's been the Kudzu Vine. Night, everybody.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for?